He was the author of SB 1070, a number of other laws. And I think what's worrying
Five
is
seconds.
He would basically empower, nationalize Arpaio's policy if at the federal government.
We're going to have to leave it there. Bahar Azmi of CCR and Roberto Lovato, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Rocks with Standing Rock on Thursday, December 15th at 8 p.m. at Dante's. This event will include native speakers, raffles, and live music by Spirit Lake, Miller & Sasser, Midlife Crisis, John Dutch, and more as a benefit for camps at Standing Rock. Again, that's Portland Rocks with Standing Rock on Thursday, December 15th at 8 p.m. at Dante's. Dante's is at 350 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is gearing up to celebrate 50 years of community radio, and we need your help. Take the Big Events Survey on kboo.fm and help us decide what kind of events you would attend or help build. Go to kboo.fm and click on the survey banner to help prepare for the Kaleidoscope of KBOO, Past, Present, and Future, 50th Anniversary Celebration.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The time is now 5 p.m. It's time for your Tuesday volunteer-produced evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the city of Aleppo may have a temporary ceasefire after thousands of civilians come under attack.
And the New York Times uncovers more about the Russian election hacking interference.
And live in studio, we talk to Gregory McKelvey of Portland's Resistance.
Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 13th, 2016. I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
And I'm Kaden Schlesinger. After months of siege, rebel forces in the Syrian city of Aleppo have agreed to ceasefire and withdraw from their positions. The battle for Aleppo has seen some of the most horrific fighting in the civil war in Syria, including the use of anti-personnel barrel bombs and so-called bunker buster bombs, with civilians often being the intentional targets. Rebel groups, many residents who couldn't take the bombardment anymore, fled towards regime-controlled areas of the city, where 79 were executed at the barricades, and the rest were taken to warehouses to face an unknown fate. He added that this morning, 20 women took their own lives in the face of systemic rape by forces fighting for Assad's regime. According to the ceasefire agreement, rebel forces will have until Wednesday night to leave the city, while an expected 50,000 people will be evacuated. The top United Nations human rights official has pleaded with the United States and other countries to take measures to protect those fleeing from Russia and Syrian forces. The retaking of the city by government forces of President Assad is seen as a victory for his backers and the Russian and Iranian governments. The takeover followed a day of intense bombing, which destroyed many buildings, leaving many trapped in the rubble. According to reports, there were over 80 civilian casualties, including 11 women and 13 children.
One inmate died and another was injured in two unrelated incidents at Columbia County Jail on Sunday. It was just after 7 p.m. when a deputy first spotted Jason Shaw hanging from a bedsheet wrapped around his neck. Shaw was given emergency treatment and eventually transported to Legacy Emmanuel Hospital in Portland. Shaw had been in the county jail since Friday on a failure to appear warrant for Rainier Municipal Court, the sheriff's office said. He was given a standard suicide screening and records show he told authorities that he had no intention of harming himself. Shaw was treated for drug withdrawal symptoms and was interviewed by medical personnel on Saturday and Sunday. He was observed by a prison guard about 45 minutes before he was found hanging. Shaw died on Monday. He was 44. Earlier in the day, another inmate attempted suicide at the same jail by using a razor blade issued for shaving purposes. The person was not identified, but was in his 40s and used the blade to slit his throat. He was taken to a Portland hospital where he was treated and ultimately released back into the jail.
A new report from a consumer watchdog group cautions holiday shoppers to beware of toys that collect internet data on kids, as well as toys that market violence and precocious sexuality. A complaint was filed last week with the Federal Trade Commission alleging that some companies are basically spying on kids online. KBOO's Al Khan has more.
A new report from a consumer watchdog group has some tips for holiday shoppers who want to avoid toys that collect internet data on kids and more. Josh Golan, with the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, says his group's 2016 report offers some safeguards when purchasing a toy for a child. He says the report shines a spotlight on toys that, in effect, spy on very young children on the web.
We try and look at some of the troubling trends that happen in the toy industry, whether it's trying to connect toys to the internet so that the toys are collecting data from children, or whether it's marketing violence to children or precocious sexuality.
Consumer groups have filed a lawsuit with the Federal Trade Commission, alleging that some toys now on the market are spying on kids, threatening their privacy and security. According to published reports and federal filings, Genesis and Nuance are the two companies named in the complaint. Neither has responded to a request for comment. Golan says shoppers play a major role in determining which toy gets called Lulu's 11-piece makeup set by Pink Fizz for the negative review,
which is marketed for children as young as three, and it encourages very young children to play out being much more mature than they actually are and focus on their appearance. And to make things even worse, the makeup itself contains chemicals which may be toxic.
The Toady Awards were created to call attention to toys oppressive and destructive to young children. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Al Khan.
Boeing announced today that it is cutting production of its 777 Jetline in August 2017 from 7 to 5 planes per month. The action will result in the loss of hundreds of jobs at Boeing's plant in Everett, Washington. Elizabeth Lund, a Boeing vice president and general manager of the 777 program and Everett manufacturing site, announced the cut to workers in an internal note. Lund attributed the cut to, quote, current market demand. Once a sales leader, Boeing 77 jets are now suffering from a global slowdown. Both Boeing and its competitor Airbus have seen sales of wide-body jets sag worldwide in 2016. The move came as Boeing announced a 30% increase in the dividend payout to its shareholders in the first quarter of August of 2017.
The Department of Energy has announced that it is refusing an inquiry from Trump's transition team for the names of members of its staff who had worked on the Obama administration's climate policy. The request was among some of the 74 questions presented to the Department of Energy, or DOE, that troubled many of its employees. Asking for the names was seen by the department as a way for Trump to keep his campaign promise to undo efforts to reduce climate change. The fact that Trump announced that the future head of the DOE would be Rick Perry, who during his campaign for president stated he would eliminate that department, only bolstered such suspicions. DOE spokesman Eben Burnham-Snyder said they will provide all publicity accessible information, but not individual names, in order to, quote, respect the professional and scientific integrity and independence of our employees. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest concurred, telling reporters that some of the questions might be an effort to remove certain career government employees. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts reacted to the questions by sending a letter to Trump, warning that using any of the information to retaliate against any federal civil servants would violate U.S. law.
The Portland-Vancouver-Hillsboro metro area, with an estimated population of 2.4 million, ranks 24th among U.S. metro areas in total personal income, or TPI. That's according to the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis. TPI is defined as the income received by all residents from all sources, everything from wages to welfare payments, in a given year. It includes income and losses from work, real estate, investments, and government sources. The $115.6 billion personal income in the area suggests it gives an average per capita income of $48,400. The top metro area in the United States was San Jose, California, at $73,900. The lowest in TPI was Riverside, San Bernardino, California, at $33,300. The Seattle-Tacoma-Bellevue area ranked 12th in the nation in income. Its population of 3.7 million has average per capita income of $61,000.
Jill Stein's three-state recount push is all but over. And the Green Party's 2016 candidate for president said Tuesday that any funds left over will be donated to groups working for electoral reform and voting rights. A representative for Stein formally withdrew her request for a recount in Michigan today. A court ordered it halted last week after 2 days of tallying. But Democratic National Committee member Mark Brewer told state election officials that the limited recount bore fruit, finding uncounted ballots and faulty machines, as well as revealing that under prevailing state law, many precincts could not recount ballots. In Pennsylvania, a judge ruled that the recount requests came too late in the game and blocked the effort from advancing. And Monday evening in Wisconsin, Election Commission Chair Mark Thompson certified the recount ahead of schedule without any significant changes in the vote totals. Free Speech Radio News' Alejandra Alonzo Galva has more.
To enter the booth, the curtains are in a closed position. Part the curtains and step inside. Move the red handle all the way to the right and leave it there.
It is a bit archaic now. But the old-style mechanical voting booth did work. What seems to never go out of style, say critics, are policies and programs designed to reduce the number of citizens who can participate in elections, mostly in the name of preventing voter fraud. Immigration hardliner and Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach is an advisor to President-elect Donald Trump and in the running for a high-level administration post. As a guest on Newsmax TV in August, Kobach alleged that undocumented immigrants could be swinging elections.
25 aliens who either got on our voter rolls or attempted to get on our voter rolls after our proof of citizenship law went into effect in just one county. Well, we have 105 counties in Kansas. And, you know, you multiply that out proportionally to the state, we're talking about hundreds of aliens on our voter rolls. We have close elections. In fact, we just had one this past Tuesday where it was a dead tie. And if you've got a handful or even one alien voting in that election, that can throw the election, or at a minimum, it cancels out the vote of U.S. citizens.
We actually tested this. It's what led states to adopt, we call it restrictor voter access legislation.
Professor Erin O'Brien chairs the Political Science Department at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Her research finds that partisanship, rather than voter fraud, is key to understanding why states pursue restrictive registration policies or legislation.
And there could be voter ID, shortening early voting, things like that. And, you know, the best predictors were partisanship, Republican control of the state legislature and governorship, and on top of that, where minority turnout had increased.
O'Brien says in practice, it's not feasible to study the personal motives of state legislators. But her research found that restrictive laws are more frequently introduced in states that elect Republican governors.
So we tested all the explanations of the left, all the explanations of the right, and voter fraud is not an explanation. It's not driving in the models why states choose to adopt restrictive voter access legislation.
Of course, the U.S. has a history of blocking certain groups of people from exercising their right to vote. In recent years, and especially since the contested presidential election in 2000, reports of voter suppression have surfaced, using descriptions such as vote caging, scrubbing, and purging. But is there a so-called smoking gun? Rahsaan Hall thinks so. He's the director of the ACLU of Massachusetts Racial Justice Program.
In the recent case out of North Carolina, where the court struck down some of the changes to the voting laws, they said that you intentionally identified the measures that would impact the greatest number of people of color or African American voters. Like, that was their rationale. In my mind, there's no question that the things that are introduced are the things that are intended to suppress the vote of people who are more likely to vote democratically, and those are overwhelmingly African Americans, other people of color, poor people, and young people, and, you know, in some instances, newly naturalized citizens.
This voting system is out of control. You have people, in my opinion, that are voting many, many times. Say what, Donald?
You have people, in my opinion, that are voting many, many times.
Reflecting Trump's claim of multiple voting Democrats, GOP-controlled states have purged nearly 1 million voters accused of voting or registering in two states.
Investigative journalist Greg Pallast has been reporting on U.S. elections for years and authored the 2004 book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, now out in comic book form and made into a movie. This year, Pallast focused his attention on something called the Interstate Crosscheck Program. Developed in Kansas under Secretary of State Chris Kobach, participating states share their voter registration rolls, and Interstate Crosscheck compares first, middle, last names, as well as the last four digits of their Social Security number. When potential duplicates arise, local election officials remove the names and, in theory, prevent people from voting multiple times. But is the provided information comprehensive and accurate? And do those deletions result in fewer votes cast? Responding to a Free Speech Radio News email survey of participating states, a spokesperson for West Virginia said her state dropped out in 2014 because data was, quote, not strong enough. When asked what that means, the spokesperson replied, "We could not determine that the records we received were voters on our list. For example, the names may have been close, but not close enough. We just were not confident in the data." Seven states responded to FSRN's survey by saying they have not seen any evidence of voter suppression or that critics don't understand the merits of voter roll maintenance. A spokesperson from Arizona called allegations of suppression baseless and inappropriate. But Bentley University professor and political scientist Jeff Gulati thinks partisanship is a factor in determining how states manage elections, and that historical and modern attempts to limit participation overlap.
There is an analog in the sense of that it's about power and it's about using undemocratic means to be able to win an election. Or let's say this, we have to distort the democratic process. And regardless if it's, you know, we can argue if it's more about race or about partisanship, democracy implies that you have very wide participation. Even if we're going to say the same parties would have won, there's still a legitimacy issue there.
While interstate crosscheck isn't the only multi-state voter roll comparison, according to the Verify Voting Foundation, more than 7 million people appear on the list, and fewer than 5 have been accused of intentionally registering or voting twice. Dave Goodman, FSRN, Boston.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Preference at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is going to be snowy in the afternoon with temperatures in the mid to low 30s all day. East of the Cascades and Hood River, expect 3 to 5 inches of snow with temperatures hovering in the mid-20s. Today in history, in 1972, Americans Eugene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt completed the third and final moonwalk of the Apollo missions. To this day, Apollo 17 remains the last human mission to the moon. The quote of the day comes from astronaut Eugene Cernan, who commanded the Apollo 17 mission. Before re-entering the lunar module for the last time, he said, quote, "America's challenge of today has forged man's destiny of tomorrow. And as we leave the moon, we leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind." This week marks the second week of the Injustice Boycott, a nationwide boycott organized by activist Sean King, aimed to focus on social injustice caused by systemic oppression. King is demanding that the city officials in San Francisco, New York, and Standing Rock meet with local activists to take action based on those meetings. KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama brings us the first of regular updates in a segment we're calling the Injustice Boycott Roundup.
It's time for KBOO's Injustice Boycott Roundup. It's time for KBOO's Injustice Boycott Roundup.
Last week, social justice activist Sean King launched what he's calling the first phase of the Injustice Boycott on the cities of San Francisco, New York, and Standing Rock. King describes the Injustice Boycott as an organized resistance designed to last for the long haul. Its launch date of December 5th was strategically chosen as it marked the 61st anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott, a boycott that lasted over 380 days. While the boycott is currently focusing on just three cities, more cities are expected to be named during the launch of Phase 2 later in January. Week 1 of the boycott has seen a rally of support from across the country with over 200,000 people pledging to take part. Successful actions have included crowdfunding over $300,000 for water protectors in North Dakota and bringing awareness to the killing of San Francisco resident Mario Woods by police. Other actions have included trending the hashtag Fire Pantaleo, a reference to the death of Eric Garner by NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo, as well as the prosecution of minors as adults in New York with the hashtag Raise the Age. As a part of the Injustice Boycott, King released audio of a meeting held earlier today that claims to be a secret recording of Energy Transfer Partners COO Matthew Ramsey talking about what the incoming administration would mean for the Dakota Access Pipeline.
But I got to tell you one thing in this room, election night changed everything here. And, you know, we now are going into a transition where we're going to have a new president of the United States, which, who gets it? He understands what we're doing here, and we fully expect that as soon as he gets inaugurated, his team is going to move to get the final approvals done, and we'll begin to put capital across Lake Hawaii.
The Injustice Boycott takes a different action every day. More information can be found at www.injusticeboycott.com or on social media at Injustice Boycott.
A group of hackers linked to the Russian government used sensitive information to influence the U.S. election in Donald Trump's favor, the New York Times reports today, in an in-depth investigation. The report finds that the Democratic National Committee did not take the situation seriously or respond with sufficient urgency to repeated warnings of the security breach. This purportedly gave the hackers nearly 7 months of unfettered access to the DNC network. In addition, the White House's lack of force in their own response may not deter future cyber attacks. Throughout the summer, private emails and confidential documents were posted on websites such as WikiLeaks and reported on widely by the American media. Donald Trump then cited these leaks in his campaign appearances. In addition to the effect that these leaks had on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, the released confidential documents also affected congressional races in a dozen states. While Russia has used similar tactics to interfere with elections in Ukraine and Europe, this is the first known attempt of such information warfare in American presidential history. While both Trump and the Russian government officials deny that there's any proof of Russian involvement in the 2016 elections, members of Congress from both sides of the party aisle have pledged to investigate further.
Many are in continued shock as President-elect Donald Trump appoints cabinet members and nominees that announced. Here's KBOO's Miriam Widman on what seems to be a distinct pattern in Trump and his advisor's strategy.
Want to head a major government department? Judging from President-elect Donald Trump's picks, you need a few qualifications. These include experience trying to dismantle the department you are being selected to lead. Numerous Trump appointees have this skill, including former Texas Governor Rick Perry, slated for energy. More on him later. And then there's Betsy DeVos, nominated to head the Education Department, and Scott Pruitt, tabbed to head the Environmental Protection Agency. It also helps if you are a billionaire. The Trump cabinet's net worth is more than $14 billion, or 50 times more than that of the cabinet led by George W. Bush. That's according to a recent CBS News report. Among those with a net worth of more than $1 billion is DeVos at Education, and then there's Wilbur Ross at Commerce. Ross is a Wall Street speculator with zero experience in either government or running a large organization. Steven Mnuchin, the pick for Treasury Secretary, is a former Goldman Sachs trader with no public policy experience. And that, of course, is yet another criteria. Zero experience in the department you've been appointed to head, or really any experience at all in running a major government department. Neurosurgeon Ben Carson fits that bill. Trump has picked him to run the housing department. Not only does Carson lack any experience in housing policy, but he also has no managerial experience. And he'll be heading an agency with more than 8,000 employees. Being a military man also helps. Trump has so far named three retired generals to his cabinet, including one to head the Defense Department, a post long held by a civilian. Trump's most recent pick, Exxon CEO Rick Tillerson, to head the State Department, has no foreign policy experience, but he does have numerous conflict of interest potential due to Exxon's vast dealings in Russia and elsewhere. But then again, Trump has yet to sort out his own conflict of interest issues. Trump planned to say how he would do that during a press conference this Thursday, but he scrapped that, and now he says he'll talk about it next month. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Miriam Widman.
President-elect Trump has selected former Texas Governor Rick Perry to be the next head of the U.S. Department of Energy. Rick Perry's appointment would put him in charge of an agency he proposed eliminating during his 2012 Republican presidential nomination bid. Perry succeeded President George W. Bush as governor of Texas in 2000 and remained in that post until 2015. The department manages U.S. energy policy and oversees the nuclear weapons program. Perry has called the science around climate change unsettled and has been an advocate of lighter regulation on the fossil fuel industry. Perry's appointment expands the list of oil drilling advocates Trump has designated for senior cabinet positions. Perry is on the board of directors of Energy Transfer Partners, the company building the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. During the Republican primary, Perry, who dropped out early, said that Trump offered, quote, a toxic mix of demagoguery and mean-spiritedness and nonsense.
The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for an explosion at a Cairo cathedral on Sunday that killed 25 and injured dozens. The suicide bombing on St. Mark's Coptic Orthodox Cathedral in Cairo, the seat of Egypt's Orthodox Christian Church, occurred during Mass and killed mostly women and children. The bomber has been identified as 22-year-old Mahmoud Shafiq Mohammed Mustafa. Four other suspects have been arrested, with others reportedly on the run.
The West African nation of Cameroon is experiencing a steep drop in wild fish stocks. Local communities that depend on coastal fisheries say that foreign vessels, many of them Chinese in origin, are illegally trawling in domestic waters and depleting their catch. FSRN's Ngala Kilian Chimtum reports from Limbe, Cameroon.
About a dozen women hover over charcoal cook fires, grilling freshly caught fish from the waters near Limbe, a seaside city of more than 80,000 where fisheries remain a major source of livelihood. But these days the future looks bleak for many fisherfolk who depend on wild fish stocks. Foreign factory trawlers, mainly from China according to local anecdotes, are illegally harvesting the prized bonga chat, a species that averages about 10 inches long and is a smoked delicacy here. Chinese trawlers are casting white nets, scraping the fishing grounds clean, which fish merchant Nicolene Tabot says are depriving her community of the prized bonga.
If you go to the market now, you will only see some type of small fish. That's all what you will see in the market. You will not see anything good.
With coastal fish stocks depleted, small-time fishermen are venturing further out to sea. But with small boats not designed for the open sea, it's very dangerous. Fisherman James Ogok explains.
We'd use a simple canoe and engine boat, and we net the Nofigo right inside the sea. These Chinese fisher people, they get all kind of machine them, all kind of BB machine them.
Conflict between industrial fishing trawlers and indigenous fleets is nothing new. That's why there are established a 3 nautical mile limit that's supposed to exclude large vessels and protect the future of the fisheries sector. Cameroon has ramped up efforts to protect its territorial waters. Last month, it announced that its navy would step up patrols. There are many Chinese companies and commercial interests in and around Limbe, and that's led to increasing tensions. Chinese fisherman Huang Chou declined to speak on tape, but he told FSRN he never fishes outside international waters. Whether or not that's true, environmentalists agree that illegal fishing is a real problem. Greenpeace Africa campaigner Ahmed Diame told FSRN that at least 5 cases of serious Chinese flagged vessels fishing inside the exclusionary zones have been reported this year. But he says while the Cameroon government talks tough, its officials often look the other way.
Corruption and lack of transparency in the management of fisheries resources is a huge challenge in West Africa. One of the consequences of this situation is that in many countries, officials and fishing companies, not only Chinese, are in collusion.
Greenpeace has long argued that outdated regulations and lack of coordination makes it easy for large fishing corporations to take advantage of weak national governments. The answer, Diame says, is to work together. But so far, that hasn't happened. Instead, Cameroon's fisheries ministry had suggested that fishermen sell their boats and invest in fish farms. Cameroon has pumped at least $25 million into developing aquaculture since 2012. This comes as foreign-owned factory trawlers continue to regularly trespass into West Africa's fishing grounds. It threatens the future of the fisheries and with it the region's way of life. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Limbe, Cameroon.
Stay tuned because coming up next, we have an interview with Portland's Resistance Gregory McKelvey.
Tomorrow is the big vote at Portland City Council on campaign finance reform. The council is ready to revive its former publicly funded election system. That's the system that helped City Commissioner Amanda Fritz get elected to her first term, one of only 8 women ever elected to the City Council in Portland in the last 150-plus years, including the 2 female mayors. The system was put on the ballot and voted down by the public in 2010. Portland's resistance plans a rally in support of the measure tomorrow from 8 to 9:30 a.m. Here to talk about that is organizer Gregory McKelvey. Thanks for being with us again, Gregory.
Yeah, of course. Anytime. Love coming out here.
So first, let's talk about Portland City Council. Who is it composed of and who is not being represented?
Sure. So we have Nick Fish, Dan Saltzman, Steve Novick, Charlie Hills, and Amanda Fritz. And coincidentally, we have no black people there. We have somebody with a British accent and no black people, and so they're being overrepresented. We're being underrepresented. But Amanda Fritz has been great on this issue. It helped her get into office. And actually, I do a lot of work in looking in who's contributing to campaigns and such. And Amanda Fritz, from what I know, is not an extremely wealthy individual, but she's always near the top of donors to other campaigns as an individual. So she understands how much, you know, when she sees a candidate that she likes, she understands that it takes so much money. So she's giving to them. But we have, I think, only had 7 people of color ever on the city council, and we've had no black women or, you know, Latino women on city council. And this is why we're underrepresented, because if you're not part of this white establishment class, it's almost impossible to get elected.
So what's before the city council tomorrow?
So it's a measure where they are going to match small donor donations 6 to 1. And so the opposition to this is basically, well, why would I be funding a candidate who I don't agree with, right? But there's so much more to it than just funding. It's the fact that candidates spend so much time on the phone talking to people. Right now, the most efficient way to do that is you're making calls to people that can donate $5,000 to your campaign. Now, what this will do, it doesn't remove money from our politics, which is the ideal thing that hopefully this will be a step towards. But what it does do is that the people that you're talking to are going to be different. I can talk to somebody that might only be able to donate $50, and it's like talking to someone that was times 6. So the issues that you get put into your brain from talking to these people are completely different, and it really represents the constituents better. But that, as well as, you know, we have corrupt politics, and we have special interests here that are really driving a lot of the decisions, including the police union contract that just happened. And the more that we talk about campaign financing and who's funding our elected officials, the more we can look into their motives and see if they're really representing us or if they're representing the people who have this big money.
So talk a little bit about those special interests. Is there anyone or any entity in particular that is sort of hiding behind any sort of veils that you want to call out?
Definitely. It's hard for me to say names, and I'd rather not do that, but sure. Developers are one of the main people that are consistently giving to our elected officials. And then we have this housing crisis that keeps being going on. We also have, at the state level and at the local level, Comcast, Northwest Natural Gas, the natural gas lobbies, Intel, Nike, these companies that get these special breaks. We had this coal to clean legislation at the state level that allows us to transition away from coal, but keeps us relying on natural gas, which is the stuff that oftentimes goes through pipelines, right? And it's not a coincidence that our Democrats in our state legislature are almost consistently and entirely funded by either Comcast, Intel, or Natural Gas Association, and that coal to clean conveniently left out natural gas from our regulations.
Hmm. So are there any limits to what entities like Comcast and Intel can contribute to certain candidates?
Not currently. No. And that's what's wrong with our politics. There should be ways to do this. But, you know, the measure that we just had, honest elections, that was voting that we voted on and voted for 186, I believe it was. That was specifically written in a way that we would it would be challenged and go to the Supreme Court so that we could relook at Citizens United. The thought was, though, that we would have another, you know, Merrick Garland would maybe be confirmed, or we would have other Supreme Court justices coming in. And by the time it got to the Supreme Court, we would be over, our state would be the state to overturn Citizens United, just like other states, you know, overturn the bans on gay marriage and stuff like that. It would be something we could be proud in. But now it looks like our Supreme Court is not going to be the type of Supreme Court that would overturn Citizens United. So our honest elections thing that we just had is almost certainly going to be overturned at the Supreme Court.
So it's interesting to look at City Hall over time and what happened when we had voter-owned elections for a few years, because there were it was like pretty divisive. There were a lot of different opinions about how that went. How do we know when voting reform has been successful? What are the markers or the metrics for that?
I think it's not just in the people, but in the policies, and if people feel that those policies reflect their needs. So right now, everybody understands that we have a horrible housing crisis, the worst in the country, probably out of major cities. Our houseless situation just gets worse every single day. But yet City Hall is doing little things and patting themselves on the back, but we can all see and feel that it's not getting better. So I think that once you have elected officials that actually represent people, I mean, it's not a coincidence. For one, another section that's not represented is nobody lives on the east side in our city council. And I don't think it's a coincidence that's where the potholes are. You know, that's what people say when they talk about City Hall and City Council, like the old school stereotypes. Well, they fix the potholes. Well, look at our potholes. Where are they? They're on the east side, and City Council is not on the east side. But I think it's successful when you see that policies reflect the needs of the community and not the needs of special interests. And right now our policies reflect the needs of special interests.
So now I kind of want to turn toward what the, like at least the ostensible temperature is on social media. Right now it seems like there's a lot of trolls posting pretty racist things on the page of Portland's Resistance event, Facebook event. Do you have any sense of why that is, and do you know who these people are? Personally,
I learned that from you just now. So I'm not, I never break my golden rule. You don't read the comments. So I don't read the comments, but there's people running the Facebook page. They probably didn't tell me about that because it would upset me. But,
sure.
You know, it's not a surprise. It's everybody was shocked when Donald Trump got elected. Like, what? There's so much of the country is racist? Yeah, so much of the country is racist. What encourages me is those racist people. One, I hope that this is their dying breath. Two, that they do their activism, if you want to call it that, or speaking out or speaking up through the keyboard, right? If you want to defeat me and what I'm doing, you're going to have to come into the streets like I am. Like, I'm doing so much more than just typing on my keyboard. So if you want to keep typing on your keyboard, that's fine. I'm going to beat you.
So focusing back on tomorrow's city council vote, many people are saying that it's kind of a done deal at this point and that the council is sure to pass the reform. So if this is true, then why call a rally?
Sure. One, you never know. Two, there are people probably, I want to see how Dan Saltzman and Nick Fish are going to vote on this, because they're the two people. Dan Saltzman already announced that he's going to be running. I want to see, so everything that he's doing is a move now to try and get elected. So I want to see if he cares more about doing what's right for the people and think that's going to be the best move for his campaign, which, you know, there could be an argument that doing the right thing will help you get votes. Or is he going to side with the money and say that money is more important in getting elected than people? So I think it's important to put pressure. I want a unanimous vote. And I want whoever doesn't vote for it to get voted out of office.
I also want to ask you about Sean King's injustice boycott that's happening. Just started last week. Are you collaborating with the injustice boycott? And what other movements are you working alongside?
Sure. So I speak with Sean King sometimes, and he named his stuff The Resistance also. So that was cool. I think he stole it from me, but whatever. But yeah, I support the boycott. It's not like what we are working on, but I definitely support it. I've been getting the emails and putting out the information or whatever. But we've been working with cities across the country. There's been a little bit of a problem in that a lot of cities want to focus on the Electoral College, which we're having a rally for the Electoral College too. But our organization's main thing was to prepare for a Donald Trump presidency, and the time to stop a Donald Trump presidency was on November 8th. And so if we spend all of our time now just working on trying to get the Electoral College to switch, then we're not going to be prepared with good policies when he comes in. So I support that, and obviously anything to get a fascist away from power is good. But that's why we haven't been working with these other cities as much as we were at the beginning. A lot of cities were looking to us for guidance with their protests, but we, you know, have been focusing on local stuff more so than stopping the Electoral College.
So how then do we prepare for a Donald Trump presidency if we can't solely rely upon institutional change and new policies? What sort of things can we do, for instance, like showing up in the street? Mm-hmm. You know, there are barriers to that. I think a lot of people that consider themselves progressives and liberals label demonstrations in the street as anarchistic. And I think there's a lot to unpack there, but can you talk about why it's important to have a critical mass showing up places and what else we can do that's not necessarily above ground?
Sure. So I think protesting is important for three things. One, community. It shows you the power of your people and your community when you come together. And looking back in history, it's very hard to find a time where people, massive amounts of people, came out to protest and they were wrong or looked disfavorably in history. It's always the counter protesters that were looked badly in history. So that's why I don't understand when we have Charlie Hales and other people in our city that are standing against the protesters. You're the Bull Connors of today, you know? Second, though, from just community is energy. You're gaining energy in being with community and being with like-minded people. You're getting ideas. But third and most importantly, it's leverage. They want you out the streets. I mean, by they, I mean the establishment. I mean, look what's going on in for DAPL right now. They want you out, so then you have more power to talk to them, because we don't have